In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorn. How have assassinations changed world history? And what can we learn by studying them as a category of political violence? For today's podcast, I spoke to Professor Michael Burley about his new book, Day of the Assassins, which explores the many facets of political murder and examines some of the key assassinations through history, from Julius Caesar and Abraham Lincoln to the mysterious killing of the Swedish Prime Minister Olaf Palme.
In the opening of the book, you say that assassinations haven't really been the subject of much serious historical study as a category of political violence. Why do you think that is?
Because I think people don't really know quite where to position it. And, you know, it in a way could come under true crime. They don't sort of thematize it, as it were, and look at it analytically, which is what I set out to do, you know, to see if I could do a sort of taxonomy of assassination, put things in different boxes. And I didn't really want to write a type of encyclopedia of assassination because it would be multi-volume. I mean, if you look at the Byzantine Empire, you know, I think about 60 out of 100 emperors got the chop, as it were, probably from their relatives or their guards. And even some of the big ones, like after I'd finished the book, I woke up in a cold sweat and realised I'd forgotten President James Garfield, partly because he was only president for 2 months. And he was shot dead by a man who fancied himself as the American consul in Paris and kept pestering the Secretary of State for the job. And they weren't going to give it to him. He was a complete non-entity. So he looked in a newspaper and worked out where Garfield would be in a station going on his holidays to New Jersey and walked up and shot him. Although it's a very interesting case, actually, that, because Garfield didn't die for a month. And when he did die, it was because this is pre the discovery of sepsis. About 9 doctors sort of put their dirty fingers into his stomach to try and locate the bullet. And of course, they poisoned him. So at this man's trial, his defense, believe it or not, was, yes, I shot him, but I didn't kill him. Well, that didn't go down too well with the juries. But I thought that was an interesting example. But you can't possibly include every assassination. I mean, it would be a room full of volumes. Of course it would.
So you highlight throughout the book different, essentially, ages of assassination. So you mentioned the Ottoman Empire. You also highlight the 19th century as a time where there was lots of assassinations, and the period from kind of 1960 to 1990. What kind of societies or eras does assassination flourish in?
Well, first of all, if you go back to my sort of archetypal assassination, which is Julius Caesar, I mean, that very much grows out of an era of civil war in the Republic. And it's largely about very ambitious men in their 30s and 40s, and their wives, of course, who see Caesar, who's only age 56 and could therefore live potentially quite a long time. I mean, after all, his successor, Augustus, lived till he was 76. So, you know, if you're a man of 30 or 40 and you see a sort of virile man of 56 who's, you know, in your way, you might wish to get rid of him. And then you'll find all sorts of pseudo-intellectual and pseudo-traditional reasons to kill him, which indeed they did. So that's one thing. And of course, his killing plunged the Republic into another couple of decades of civil war. As a result, at the end of that, Rome ceased to be a republic, effectively. I mean, I know that Augustus retained the outward trappings of a republic, the Senate, etc. But in fact, it had been hollowed out, and it was largely imperial dictatorial rule from then onwards. Now, if you look at a later example, the whole era of European religious wars, sectarian wars, that was certainly a spike in assassination, for the simple reason that if you killed, a monarch who you had deemed to be a heretic, you could potentially change the whole religious orientation of a state or of a people. You know, you just knock off the Protestant, and then they all become Catholics if there's a Catholic replacement, or vice versa. And, you know, I was quite surprised, you know, that the most Catholic monarch, Philip II of Spain, was offering pretty big cash bounties. I mean, a lot of money in those terms for anyone who'd kill William the Silent or Elizabeth I. And people acted in order to collect the reward, the bounty. I mean, the man who did kill William the Silent in the Netherlands, the Calvinist ruler of the Netherlands, I mean, he was trying to get the money. Of course, you get caught on the spot and tortured and executed, but that was the motivation. The Venetians, by the way, were of course, a little earlier, very adept at this, because they murdered all sorts of people, and they had, the assassins actually had tariffs, which I reproduce in the book. So you'd get so many hundred gulden if you killed, you know, the Turkish, the Ottoman emperor. You'd get so much if you killed the Pope. You'd get so much if you killed the King of Spain. And he worked his way. And he said, of course, we have to factor in my travelling expenses as well.
I wanted to ask you about assassins, because I think if you said assassins to a lot of people, they would think of, say, a sniper from a Bourne movie or a James Bond movie. So can we make any generalized statements about assassins? Is there a type of person that becomes an assassin? And also, is this idea of the contract killer out for hire really that accurate when we look at history?
Well, it's a very sort of, the idea of a man with a rifle, it's usually a man. I mean, it can be a woman in some, you know, that's very much the generalization of a very particular American context in the 60s and 70s, where, you know, President Kennedy and Martin Luther King were assassinated by men using rifles. Not very sophisticated rifles, but nonetheless rifles. In fact, that happens very, very rarely in terms of assassination. And a lot of professional assassins, they actually rule it out. The most frequent ways of killing somebody are, you know, with a handgun, knives, or bombs. Without fail. Bombs, of course, have the massive advantage that you can set the timer for a very long period in advance. I mean, if you think of Georg Gelser, who almost killed Hitler in November 1939, I mean, he set the timer a week before the bomb went off. So he had a long time to get away from it. And likewise, Patrick McGee, who blew up Thatcher and the Conservative Party in the Grand Hotel in Brighton, you know, that bomb was built into the bathroom wall a long time before the Thatcher ever used the bathroom. And, you know, it went off with a very advanced timer. So that gives you lots of advantages if you're going to assassinate somebody.
One of the assassinations you look at is that of Abraham Lincoln. And you quote Benjamin Disraeli, who said after the assassination in 1865, "Assassination has never changed the history of the world." Would you agree with that statement or disagree?
Well, it's sort of like him, it's sort of glib and superficial. So, you know, yes, all right, there's lots of people who pointed out if you kill Alexander II, you get Alexander III. I mean, Tsar Alexander II, Alexander III. But even in that case, a man who was, you know, known as the Tsar Liberator and a relative reformer in that setup was replaced by his 36-year-old son, who thought a good, you know, night out with the family was for them, the kids, to watch him ripping packs of playing cards in half with his bare hands. It takes a lot of strength to do that. He was a very tough guy and an ultra-nationalist, Alexander III. But even in the case of Lincoln, which is what Disraeli was referring to when he said that, he's quite wrong, because Lincoln's successor, Andrew Johnson, was a slave-owning Southerner, And he did his very best to decelerate the various pieces of emancipation legislation. And I would say he had quite a big responsibility for creating a system of legalized segregation. So Lincoln certainly wouldn't have done that. So even in those terms, just with the case that Disraeli was thinking about, he was quite wrong. What we didn't talk about was the fact that in some cases, although assassins can either be so-called lone wolves or part of very small groups like Booth and his associates who killed Lincoln. I mean, it was maybe, you know, half a dozen people, plus a wider group of people who probably didn't even know they were involved in an assassination plot. Nonetheless, you could plausibly claim that they were acting on behalf of a very sizable chunk of American opinion. You know, in the American South, I mean, Confederate sympathizers who blamed, you know, they saw Lincoln as the sort of devil incarnate in a way, who commanded the Union forces and had won the war. And they would have openly welcomed his assassination.
Could you name two or perhaps three assassinations that you think have made the biggest impact on world history in terms of initiated the biggest changes?
Yeah, well, one would undoubtedly be Julius Caesar, which I referred to earlier, because it resulted in the disintegration of a republic which was, I don't know, 600-700 years old. And after that event, it gradually ceased to be a republic, and you get several hundred years in the Western Empire of emperors. And then in the case of the Eastern, the Byzantine Empire, I mean, they go on to, 1453? So that's a massive change ensuing from an assassination, notwithstanding the fact that lots of those emperors were themselves assassinated for various reasons. But no, there've been, I mean, if you take a much more recent example, the assassination of President Habyarima of Rwanda in 1994, actually, his plane went down and one of the other passengers was the president of Burundi. So it was like a double hit, as it were, on two of them. I mean, within hours of that event, bearing in mind that American and Belgian diplomats had already said, you know, something terrible here, genocidal will happen, especially if there's an assassination. Well, lo and behold, the moment that plane went down, the Hutu sort of extremists just instantly implemented plans which they'd put in place and carried out a sort of holocaust on the Tutsi population. And in 100 days, you know, they killed nearly a million people. So that's a hell of a big consequence of an assassination.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
Well, Hitler, of course, was very lucky not to be blown to pieces by Georg Elser. I mean, it's very uncharacteristic of him, but he cut short a speech. But, I mean, had he still been speaking, he'd been blown to pieces in November 1939, without a doubt. And that would have had enormous consequences in terms of, you know, that millions of lives wouldn't have been lost.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
One of history's most famous, I guess you would say, assassinations is credited with starting World War One widely, that the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand. Do you think that that's just a historical misconception, or do you think it's fair to say that that really was the spark that set World War One alight?
Well, I've thought about this quite a lot, actually, but I would say that you know, some of the great powers involved very much were seeking a pretext to go to war, and that could be Austria-Hungary in the case of Serbia, which they were undoubtedly wanted to crush, because in some senses Serbia was performing the same function that Piedmont had played in creating a united Italy, or Prussia had played in creating a united Germany. It was a relatively dynamic place. So they were looking to smash Serbia, which, of course, was allied with the Russians. And then on top of that, the German government and the military was clearly incredibly anxious about the fact that if they didn't go to war very soon against what they perceived to be their encircling enemies, that they would sort of miss the chance, the window of opportunity would close, and they wouldn't be in such a strong position vis-a-vis France or Russia, let alone England, in a few years' time. So, you know, the assassination came along very opportunely for anybody who wanted to go to war. But I'm sure, you know, that Austria and Serbia would have found a reason to go to war quite regardless of the assassination.
So let's just talk a bit about some of the ages of assassination that you identify here. So how about the late 19th century? What made that such a period rife with assassination?
It's a couple of things. One is that there are various ideologies, be it anarchism, nihilism in the Russian case, or nationalism, which actually don't just practice violence, they regard it as almost purgative, sacred, and, you know, entirely justified. So you have people who think it's perfectly all right to use extreme violence up to and including killing people. And an awful lot of people, I mean, I was quite surprised myself that, you know, the number of judges and policemen and whatever who were assassinated, usually by socialist revolutionary terrorists in late 19th, early 20th century Russia, not to speak of the Prime Minister, Stolypin, is a very large number of people. It runs into thousands being bumped off. So that's the first thing. And then anarchists, obviously, I mean, I'm not condemning anarchism per se, but there are strains of anarchism which certainly believe that, you know, you should strike at the powers that be, whether it's rural landlords or capitalists or just the bourgeoisie, hence why you chuck a bomb into an opera house, you know, to hit that audience. And they think violence is entirely, and they write books, they write pamphlets saying this is all fine, go and do it. The second factor, which is much more just prosaic in a way, is that by the late 19th century, whether it's monarchs or prime ministers or presidents, you know, had to be seen by the public. They weren't cowering inside a palace. They had to go out and about. And there were lots more venues like museums, art galleries, opera houses, theatres, railway stations, where they were very public. And indeed, they were encouraged to go and press the flesh. I mean, if you think of President McKinley in America, who was killed in 1901, he was at a trade expo in Buffalo, New York, upstate New York, and he was in the act of shaking hands with people who wanted to, you know, say hello to him, when somebody came up, an anarchist, and with his hand wrapped in a type of cloth, and shot him in the stomach. So it's just a factor of visibility. There's a third factor, which I think is very underrated, is, of course, newspapers. Because newspapers helped all the assassins. So if you were young Gavrilo Princip wondering where's best to shoot Archduke Franz Ferdinand, you didn't have to do any deep research. You just bought the local Bosnischer Post, and it said a week in advance, well, his convoy will be at such and such a spot, and it will move along such and such a street, and he'll stop there and glad hand the mayor. You didn't have to do any work at all. And most of the assassins in the 19th century were just looking up the newspapers, including James Garfield. I mean, the man who killed him, as I mentioned earlier, in the 1880s, he read that he would be in some station in Washington going on his summer holidays in New Jersey. So he knew exactly where he was, and he walked up and shot him.
Talking about the killing of public figures in public places, one of the most interesting unsolved assassinations that you look at is the shooting of the Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme in 1986. What do we know about that, and why is it such an interesting case?
Well, it's been rehashed and reported on again and again by Swedish investigators. And then there's a whole sort of who killed Palmer subculture, you know, of people who put up various theories. So, you know, there are dozens of theories. I mean, that he was killed because, you know, by Kurdish terrorists or whatever is one, that, you know, he was killed because of his general diplomatic stance in the world is another. You know, it just goes on and on and on. Anyway, I mean, the thing is that Sweden was profoundly shocked by it because it's a pretty benign, pacifistic place. And he and his wife just went out to the cinema one night and somebody walked up and shot him at point-blank range in the back. But that person has never really been found. And also, of course, the whole police investigation was just completely botched. Right from the beginning, the crime scene was botched. You know, witness statements were botched. Everything was botched that could be botched. And it was like sort of Inspector Clouseau was in charge of the investigation. So anyway, they and the media, because the police were constantly releasing stuff to the media and giving sensational names like the Phantom to the assassin, because people gave physical facial descriptions of a face, although, you know, that's problematic. And of course, Mrs. Palmer claimed to have seen the assassin too, although she in fact had a sort of hysterical breakdown at the scene. People have tried to, come up with different, more or less elaborate theories about who killed him. They've identified various people. One man was actually put on trial for killing him and was subsequently acquitted and heavily compensated. Although I think in the book I come round to the view that he actually did it. That's just my hunch. And everything else is just, you know, speculation.
I wanted to ask you about failed assassinations. And I know that we can never tell how things would have worked out if something had happened differently. But what do you think are some of the failed assassinations that came really close to altering the course of history?
Well, Hitler, of course, was very lucky not to be blown to pieces by Georg Elser. I mean, it's very uncharacteristic of him, but he cut short a speech for once in his life because he could go on for hours and decided to go back to Berlin from Munich, where he was talking to his old comrades. And had he hung around to continue the speech, I think he cut the speech short because he was planning the invasion of France, so he had to get back to Berlin to do that. But, I mean, had he still been speaking, he'd been blown to pieces in November 1939, without a doubt. And that would have had enormous consequences in terms of, you know, the millions of lives wouldn't have been lost. And indeed, at that point, I suspect the given that none of the other Nazi leaders quite shaped up with his particular set of characteristics, I'd have thought that the German military command would have been in very good position to carry out some sort of putsch, which, you know, okay, military government, but it could have been a military government which would have taken on more benign forms or reverted to democracy after a few years. You know, who knows?
So clearly assassinations, Disraeli was wrong. Assassinations have really changed the face of history.
Definitely. You haven't asked me who my favourite assassins are. I would say, without a doubt, the most professional assassins of the book were the Soviet NKVD. And these are men who were, and women actually, who were sent first of all to the Republican side in the Spanish Civil War to take care of ideological deviants and Trotskyites and any nationalists they got their hands on. And given that most of them were actually Russians, they then became plausibly Spanish to the point where you would not recognize that they were not Spanish. And then if Stalin wanted to deploy them somewhere else, you could send them to, I don't know, Costa Rica, and they would claim quite plausibly to be born in Costa Rica, you would not know the difference. This is just so incredibly professional. And if you look at the mother and son team that murdered Trotsky, you know, the son, Ramon, was clearly a professional assassin, had killed a lot of people in Spain and afterwards. The mother was a professional assassin. She was a Cuban Spanish aristocrat. And Ramon Mercado, who did kill Trotsky in the end, I mean, I was quite fascinated by him because he had about five layers of identities, okay? And even though he was caught and beaten up after he'd killed Trotsky, by the way, his mother was outside in the getaway car, but she never got to get away, or he didn't. When he was in prison for 20 years, I think for the first 6 months, criminologists and psychiatrists talked to him for 6 hours a day, 6 days a week for 6 months. And he would talk about his dreams, about his relationships with his mother and father. They would get him to do psychometric tests in dark rooms, like moving his hand across different height objects and then being able to draw them afterwards, taking a rifle to bits and putting it together in 3 minutes in a blindfold, etc. And at no point did they ever get beyond the first two identities. I mean, they knew who he was saying he was when he was caught. He was pretending to be a Canadian called Frank Jackson. They knew that he'd adopted that name when he was supposed to be a Belgian playboy, which is how he had a love affair with one of Trotsky's secretaries, which is how he got into the Trotsky circle. So they got down to those two. But then there were three other identities down below that. And after 10 years, bearing this in mind, one of the policemen went to Madrid or Barcelona on holiday, and he had a mugshot of this man in his wallet. Just out of interest, he went into the police station and said, "Have you ever come across this character?" So they went through their files, and they said, "Yes, that's Ramon Mercado. He was here during the Civil War, fighting on the Republican side." And that's the only point where they knew his identity. It's just incredible ability to become somebody else. And then it's also very sophisticated in the sense the NKVD had psychiatrists working for them, psychologists. So they would, for example, use somebody to establish whether you would take a gift from a relative stranger. So if somebody came up to you in a restaurant or bar and said, "Oh, Mr. So-and-so, I'd love to give you a box of cigars or chocolates, would you take it?" And lots of people do. Now, once you've established that principle, the next box of chocolates is going to blow you in half.
That was Michael Burley. His book, Day of the Assassins, A History of Political Murder, is out now, published by Picador. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman, and Brittany Colley.